Next case is 04304, Maria Johnson versus Microsoft Corporation. Justice Pfeiffer has recused himself from this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Pfeiffer, Judge Peggy Bryant, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 10th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Bryant. Mr. DeMarco.
Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'm splitting my time today with Mr. Cole, who will argue on Attorney General Petro's behalf in favor of reversal. This is an appeal from a dismissal pursuant to Rule 12b-6. This case presents a claim under Ohio's 107-year-old antitrust statute, the Valentine Act. It was brought on behalf of the businesses and citizens of Ohio who, in buying personal computers equipped with Microsoft's operating system, bore the brunt of that company's judicially recognized monopoly over the operating market. Now, the issue before the court is not whether there is a Valentine Act claim for that monopoly or whether the Valentine Act permits a claim for damages. The sole issue before the court, or the primary issue before this court, is who may bring that damage claim. It's perfectly clear from the Court of Appeals decisions, particularly its reconsideration denial, that the Court of Appeals felt there was one and only one reason why it needed to uphold the dismissal of the Valentine Act claim. It concluded that it had to follow the United States Supreme Court's decision in Illinois Brick, because the Court of Appeals believed that this court in CK mandated that Ohio courts follow federal law when interpreting the Valentine Act. Court of Appeals believed, essentially, that it had no choice to interpret the Valentine Act differently from the federal court's interpretation, and indeed Illinois Brick's interpretation of federal antitrust law on that key question that I identified: who may bring the damage claim. As the Court of Appeals said at Appendix 14, the rules of the game were established in CK, unquote. So the key question before the court is, did this court in CK really lay down a rule that required the Court of Appeals to follow federal antitrust law, including Illinois Brick's controversial holding, which said that direct purchasers may seek antitrust damages even when they pass on the monopolistic overcharge, but that indirect purchasers, who are the end users and can't ever pass it along, may not seek damages. That was the holding of Illinois Brick that the Court of Appeals made clear it felt constrained to apply to Ohio law. Now, the question, did CK establish that rule? I think the language of CK bears close examination. CK said that, and by the way, in CK the court was looking into whether or not the conduct would constitute a violation of antitrust law, which we believe is different from the question of standing before the court.
That was a substantive issue versus a procedural issue.
That's right. And CK said that it has been the practice of this court to, in reviewing statutory language of the Valentine Act, to do so in light of the federal construction of the Sherman Act. I think there are two important points there: statutory language of the Valentine Act and in light of, interpreting it in light of, the judicial construction by the federal courts of the Sherman Act. That's important because of this court's prior holdings for many years that the only way that this court gets to judicial interpretation of a statute is when this court finds an ambiguity in the statute that warrants interpretation. As the court said in Clark versus Capelli, no ambiguity, no interpretation necessary. So the first point, I think, that comes up under CK and the defendant's argument and the Court of Appeals use of it is there even an ambiguity in 1331.08 or 1331.01 for which we need to resort to a federal court's interpretation of a different statute? As the court said in Gutman versus Feldman, no ambiguity, then we do not resort to federal statutes that are analogous to our state statutes.
The Valentine Act is about as clear as the Sherman Act, would you say, in that regard? One says any purchaser, Valentine Act says the purchaser.
I would say it's as clear as the Sherman Act.
I'm sorry, it's the Sherman Act.
Yeah, and the Clayton Act in terms of Section 4.
So why
but, Your Honor, I think the key point is to look at, as the court said, that it's going to interpret the statutory language in light of the federal court construction. The key point there is, I think you look at Illinois Brick in vain for any true statutory construction. You notice in Illinois Brick, the court was not parsing the words of Section 4 and saying that this is what this word means versus that word. Illinois Brick, if you will, was a hypothesis about what would happen from a public policy standpoint if you allowed indirect purchaser claims, not a construction standpoint.
And involved a lot of tripping over hand over shoe in getting to that point.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, why wouldn't it be advisable or desirable for the two statutes, the Ohio and the federal, to be interpreted consistently?
I would agree with you if we were talking about the kind of conduct that constitutes an antitrust violation. That's what CK was talking about. We need uniformity in terms of that conduct. But here we're talking about who may bring a damages claim. And there, I think California versus Arc America, which came after Illinois Brick, showed what the United States Supreme Court felt about this tolerating the tension between direct purchaser and indirect purchaser actions. It said in Arc America that they could peacefully coexist. In fact, in Arc America, remember, those claims were side by side. You had the federal direct purchaser claims and you had the state indirect purchaser claims. Those parties were put together in one class and there was no problem. So if you're talking about what conduct violates antitrust laws, I would agree with you. There should be national uniformity. But as Arc America shows, there's no need for national uniformity on the question of who may bring a damages claim. Arc America tolerated that coexistence. And in fact, for 28 years since Illinois Brick, and approximately 20 years since the decision in Arc America, we have had indirect purchaser actions that have coexisted with direct purchaser actions, and all of the conditions that Illinois Brick predicted would result, overly complicated proceedings. There's no indication of that coming out of all of that history of state indirect purchaser actions. The risk of multiple liability, there's no indication of that coming out of that history. And then the key point—
Let me ask you one thing here, though. You characterized this as an issue of standing. Didn't Illinois Brick characterize it as an antitrust injury?
You can really read Illinois Brick as an antitrust injury case. And let me explain why. Even under federal law, an indirect purchaser has the right to seek equitable relief for its antitrust injury. The only question is, could it seek damages? And Illinois Brick said no. But even under federal law, it can seek equitable relief for its antitrust injury. It's not a question of whether the indirect purchasers under federal law have an antitrust injury. It is a question of, can they bring a damages claim? That third point from Illinois Brick, I think in time, really has proved to be unfounded. And I think the Microsoft litigation is the truest test of all. Remember, they said the key policy objective in all of what we're doing today in Illinois Brick is we're trying to encourage enforcement by private attorneys general of the antitrust statutes. And we think that's best done by the direct purchasers. Well, look what's happened in the Microsoft litigation. Keep in mind, Microsoft was found guilty of violating antitrust laws in United States versus Microsoft, but not one direct purchaser, Dell, Compaq, has ever filed a lawsuit against Microsoft based on that violation. 100, at last count, 100 indirect purchaser actions have been filed in the various states. And the question that I want to leave with you before turning my time over to Mr. Cole is, why should Ohio be left out? Why should all of the other states that have recognized, whether it's by statute or case law, and there are five of them that have recognized it by case law, why should Ohio be left out of that? Why should Ohio businesses and Ohio citizens have to suffer, contrary to Section 16, Article 1, without a remedy at all? And the indirect purchasers, the end users in all of those other states, that they should have the remedy that Ohio citizens and businesses lack. Your Honors, there is nothing in 1331.08 that requires you to so find. Section 1331.08 is ambiguous on this point. Person who has suffered injury in their business or property, all of these indirect purchasers as end users qualify for that. The inquiry should begin and end with the language of the statute, and I'll turn over my time to Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Cole.
May it please the court, Doug Cole on behalf of Attorney General Jim Petros and amicus in this matter. I will try to be brief to save some time for my colleague for rebuttal, but I did want to make three points. First, there's nothing in Ohio law that forces this court to blindly follow federal law and federal law interpretation of the Sherman Act in interpreting our own Valentine Act. Second, the plain language of our statute does not include the indirect purchaser limitation that Microsoft seeks here. And third, public policy shows that it would be a bad idea to engraft that limitation onto Ohio law. With regard to the first, to just amplify a point that Mr. DeMarco was making, CK cannot be read to establish a mandate that we must blindly follow whatever the federal court happens to say at the time is the proper interpretation of the Sherman Act in looking at our own different language in the Valentine Act. The quote, the statute, we should interpret the statutory language in light of federal judicial construction, not the language of a mandate. This court also said in the List case, which we cite in our brief, that a comparison of the Sherman Act and the Valentine Act shows that the Ohio law is much broader and stronger in its terms than the federal enactment.
Couldn't we wait for the legislature, though, to act? In the other states where there is this distinction, there is legislative action. Could we not also wait for that?
The court needs to determine as an initial matter what the default rule is going to be. That is, where are we now? The legislature doesn't know whether or not it needs to act until we know what the default rule is. And in choosing that default rule, I mean, that argument could equally be applied to the Microsoft version. We can say the default rule is indirect purchasers can sue, and if we don't like that as a legislative matter, the legislature can change it. We need clarity, and in looking at that, so looking to get that clarity, I just don't see anything in our statute or in public policy that suggests this court should interpret the Valentine Act to include that limitation. If the General Assembly, in its wisdom, decides to impose that limitation through the Valentine Act, it can easily do so. But there's no need for them to do it until the court makes it clear what the background rule is. In fact, I would hesitate to even call it an Illinois brick repealer if there were a statute before the General Assembly, because we're not repealing anything. We don't, you know, there's no clear indication in Ohio that Illinois brick has been adopted. And in fact, the better course, based on this court's pronouncements that, you know, it's a stronger, the Valentine Act is stronger than the Sherman Act. We believe it's already there. So at most, if the legislature acted, it would be to clarify what we believe is already there, that in fact the Illinois BRIC indirect purchaser limitation is not part of Ohio law, nor should it be.
How do you address the argument that this exposes the defendants to multiple liabilities in various lawsuits?
Certainly, Your Honor, there would need to be some type of allocation undertaken. It's not our position that there should be duplicative recoveries against Microsoft in this case. The allocation question would need to be worked out. It might well be the case, given the facts here, that there was 100% pass-through, and so, you know, when we go back down, when the parties go back down and engage in that factual question, you'll find 100% pass-through and won't even need to address it then. But we do recognize, in urging this rule that indirect purchasers be allowed to sue, that we do need to come up with some kind of allocation mechanism to ensure that there aren't duplicative recoveries.
And is that so difficult that it precludes the indirect purchaser from being able to sue?
25 states have found that it's not so difficult that it prevents that. 25 states allow indirect purchasers to sue. They've managed in their court systems to work out a way to make it happen, and I would suggest that Ohio's judiciary is equally up to the task that those other states have faced.
Of that 25, how many had legislative action to rely on?
I don't have that in front of me, Your Honor. I apologize. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is David Tulchin for Appellee Microsoft. The appellant here asked this court not only to ignore, in fact, to change longstanding precedent that the courts of Ohio should interpret the Valentine Act consistent with federal law, but after ignoring that, to promulgate a rule 180 degrees contrary. Indeed, 25 states, roughly, have refused to depart from federal law. Almost all of those that have repealed Illinois BRIC have done so through the legislature. I believe the count is 22. And in one of the others, North Carolina, there's a recent decision which seems to contradict the intermediate appellate court's prior decision that Illinois BRIC could be repealed judicially.
Of those that have followed Illinois BRIC, how many had statutory mandates that required them to do that?
Difficult to count, because sometimes beauty is in the eye of the beholder as to whether prior law required harmonization. But roughly half the states have followed Illinois BRIC, and those that haven't, almost in every case, have not done so as a result of the legislative action that we've referred to. Indeed, I think the Attorney General in his brief referred to a sort of firestorm of reaction to Illinois BRIC 28 years ago, which resulted in the legislative repealers that we've referred to. In fact, two neighboring states, Kentucky and Indiana, have faced this exact same question under circumstances where their legislatures had not acted either and came out the way we urge, that is, followed federal law. In fact, neither the plaintiff here nor the amici have cited any case in Ohio or any case applying Ohio law where a court, in interpreting the Valentine Act, failed or refused to follow federal precedent.
But why should we hear?
Well, I think the court, in fact, has faced that issue and, in effect, already decided it. That is, already decided that procedural federal antitrust rules are the law of Ohio.
In light of means that, what you just said? CK said in light of, and you're saying that means that it's...
It did. But with all respect to Judge Bryant, I don't think that was a mere observation. I think that was the court instructing that federal law should be followed. Four appellate courts in the last 10 years have looked at the language of CK and decided, just as we urge, that federal law should be followed. The Acme Wrecking...
Counsel, excuse me, again, that That was based on an ambiguity in the nature of the conduct, was it not?
No, it was not, Your Honor. That had to do, the CK case did. The Acme Wrecking case and the others that I was about to cite to you were cases involving procedure. That is, what constitutes an antitrust injury sufficient for a particular plaintiff to recover damages? Acme Wrecking, this is the first appellate district, 1995. Understood CK to instruct that federal law must be followed,
But again, we and this court decide what our opinions mean.
Yes,
so
certainly,
it really isn't terribly relevant to us what the Court of Appeals thinks a Supreme Court decision means, or language, words in the Supreme Court.
Yes, but there have been four in the last 10 years that have applied federal law in a situation quite close to this. That is the question whether a particular plaintiff has suffered antitrust injury, not whether the conduct involved might violate the law. For instance, in the Schweitzer case, Judge Bryant, I know you were part of that panel, the Schweitzer case involved the question of whether or not a doctor denied staff privileges could sue to recover damages.
Illinois Brick was not a part of that case.
No, of course it wasn't.
It a focus on the defendant's conduct to see whether it arose to an antitrust violation?
No. The antitrust violation was assumed and was a given as part of the decision. The question there, and quoting Schweitzer here, the requirement imposed on the plaintiff there was to allege and show that his loss, quote, must stem from a competition-reducing aspect or effect of the alleged antitrust misconduct. Very similar to the Illinois Brick rule.
But Chief Justice Moyer raised the point that, you know, we don't have to follow those cases. Why?
Well, should we follow
Illinois Brick?
You know, the question of whether the statute should be applied literally, whether there's an ambiguity, this court has answered that question, in fact, in the List case going back to 1926, where this court said if the Valentine Act should be construed literally, you could never have a partnership, no corporation could be organized, etc. That is, without the rule of reason, borrowed from federal law, from the Standard Oil case, the Valentine Act would be meaningless.
Well, if you apply the rule of reason, they cite that there is no incentive for direct purchasers, the middlemen, to ever pursue these actions, and therefore they never are followed up because the indirect purchaser, who actually bears the brunt of the damage, has no standing.
Well, of course,
Do you have any examples of middlemen who have actually pursued antitrust violation claims?
Well, yes, certainly there are many instances where that has occurred, and in fact, the lawyers here should know that there have been direct purchaser actions against Microsoft in the federal court in Baltimore, one of which was settled in 2003 by Microsoft.
Who was the direct purchaser?
The direct purchasers there were consumers who purchased directly from Microsoft.
Okay, but the middleman still is not in that picture, correct? That's a direct consumer that went beyond or around a middleman.
Yes, there have been many, many suits brought against Microsoft by competitors as well as indirect purchasers and direct purchasers.
But direct purchasers didn't have that middleman.
Correct. In those instances, that's correct.
Do you have
Your
any
Honor.
Examples of what we call are calling in this case the middleman pursuing a direct action?
No, there have been no actions filed. That isn't to say that there haven't been resolutions. There have been no actions filed by middlemen.
And doesn't that then merit, if we look at what does Ohio mean? Doesn't that merit allowing the indirect person to have standing under the way the statute's written?
Only if this court were to ignore the CK case, ignore the List case, and I do submit that stare decisis is important in this area as in any other, to ignore those cases which say that federal law, whether procedural or substantive, And the question of antitrust injury certainly is a procedural one. Who can sue? What's happened in those cases is that Ohio courts, including this one, have engrafted onto the Valentine Act the extra requirement found nowhere in the statute that it's not just the violation which gives rise to the claim, and it's not just the person injured who may sue, but that any individual plaintiff must allege and show that it's the competition lessening aspect of the behavior which caused his injury.
So your basic argument is that we don't look at those policy arguments, we don't look at the reasons, we don't look at what's behind the valve. We look at strictly what did the federal court say, and we lockstep it.
Well, the question of whether we lockstep, I think, is somewhat misstating our position. The question here is, 27 years ago, the Illinois brick decision came down from the Supreme Court, 28 now, and the Ohio legislature has several times since modified or amended the Valentine Act without ever taking up this question that 25 other state legislatures have of whether that rule found in federal law, clearly from the U.S. Supreme Court, should be part of Ohio law, of Valentine Act.
The so you're ceiling saying, against. You're saying, in effect, the legislature has already spoken to this issue.
I'm saying that under Seeley against Expert Inc., a 1971 decision of this court, yes, that the legislature's decision to ignore what other states were doing in repealing, if you will, the principle of Illinois brick may be accepted as unqualified recognition of legislative intentions. I'm quoting from this court's decision. And the ARC America case made very plain, that's from the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1980s, that if state legislatures chose a different rule, they were free to do so without any conflict with federal law. That's why there was this rush in many, many states to repeal, if you will, Illinois brick. And that's why the courts in Kentucky and Indiana and something like 20 other states where there are no repealer statutes have decided that federal law should be followed, that it is desirable for the law of each individual state, the antitrust law, to be harmonized procedurally and substantively.
Wasn't our Valentine Act adopted prior to Illinois brick?
Yes, certainly, as were the antitrust laws of all these other states.
What do you say to the argument that when that occurs, that the state, when the state adopts its statute, it assumes the federal law in place at the time it adopted its statute?
Well, of course, there was no rule of reason in place when the Valentine Act was adopted either. And if the courts do not permit the evolution of the law through federal precedents and otherwise, I do submit we would be at a rather chaotic state where a state court evaluating an antitrust action would have to look back to the date on which, in this case, the Valentine Act was passed to determine what federal law was all those many years ago.
Well, should we give the General Assembly credit for knowing about that principle of law, that it didn't need to do anything after Illinois brick because it had adopted the Valentine Act prior to Illinois brick, and so the federal law in place before Illinois brick controls?
Well, I think just the contrary.
That gives you too much credit?
I think maybe the credit should go the other way, that when state legislatures all around the country were considering this very issue, and Ohio determined not to pass such a statute, that legislative intentions can be gleaned quite clearly from that fact.
Why could our legislature not simply look at the words of O2 and decide that those words are very broad, the words in the statute are very broad? I mean, for those of us who attempt to apply words of statutes when they're not ambiguous, that's a bit of a burden, isn't it, for you to overcome?
Well, again, Your Honor, the List case says quite clearly the Valentine Act will not be construed literally. The Schweitzer case says the same thing, that a literal interpretation of the plain language of the Valentine Act was rejected by this court in List. And Lee against United Church Home from 1996, another appellate decision, says Ohio courts reject a strict interpretation of the act and, in fact, do not honor the plain language of the statute. But speaking of plain language, and I'm sliding to a slightly different point, but I think one that's important here, the Valentine Act's plain language requires two or more actors. Unlike the Sherman Act or the Clayton Act, Section 1331.01b and 02 in each case require two or more persons. That's the definition of a trust in part. There must be two or more persons. And in prohibiting various types of conduct, a combination, contract, or agreement is required for the conduct to be unlawful under Ohio law. There is one defendant in this case, Microsoft alone. There never has been, in either the original complaint or amended complaint, any allegation that Microsoft acted with any other person. Indeed, this is a monopolization claim case. Microsoft allegedly acted alone to become a monopolist. And the only case that the plaintiffs have cited on the subject of whether a second person is necessary is a 1910 case, which has never been cited for this reason, or as far as I know, for any other reason, by any subsequent Ohio court, which says that a corporation can conspire with its own officers or employees, something that I would respectfully submit is outmoded in the law. So there was this second argument, second reason. It's an important part of this case as well. The allegations here, even if you accept that Illinois Brick ought not to be followed, and I do contend again that that would violate the important principle of stare decisis for both the List case and the CK case, and the understanding, unanimous understanding, of the Ohio court since. But even considering all that, two or more actors are required under the plain language of the Valentine Act. And there is no case that we know of where the Valentine Act has been applied in private litigation seeking damages like this as against one actor. Thank you very much for your attention. We ask that the decision be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Tolchin. Mr. DeMarco, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds and let me consume it for you with a question.
Thank you.
The last point that Mr. Tolchin made is one that I wanted to ask you, whether Microsoft here acting alone, and you argued that, well, it has employees and they all got together and all, it takes more than just, and the corporation acts through people.
Right.
What is your strongest argument on that point, that O2, his argument that O2 doesn't really apply to Microsoft here?
Well, I think you have to go back to 1898 when the Valentine Act was enacted. It was clearly enacted in order to prevent monopolization. Their argument, essentially, the logical extension of it is monopolization is legal in Ohio. List said just the opposite, that the Valentine Act was aimed at monopolization. If I may, Your Honor, go back to your point about the legislature and how much credit do we give them. The last time that the legislature, before this case was filed, amended the Valentine Act was 1976. Your Honors, Illinois Brick was decided the next year. You cannot ascribe to the legislature knowledge of a statute that did, of a case that didn't exist. Beyond that, then you have the problem of legislative inaction, and as this court held in Rice versus Certainteed, refusing to enact a law has no legal effect. The questions that were asked about how many states, you can add up these things, these states, in a lot of different ways, and it calls to mind the observation of Yogi Berra that 90% of baseball is mental and the other half is physical. Here, I urge the court to focus on the Supreme Court decisions in Iowa, in Nebraska, in Arizona, perhaps the closest being Arizona, where they had a statute that permissively allowed the court to use federal interpretations as a guide, just like CK, and they overcame that in Bunker's Glass and found Illinois brick will not be applied in Arizona. I urge the court to find exactly the same way.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.